From NPR News, this is Foreign Dispatch, a weekly roundup of some of the best coverage of news and events filed by NPR correspondents from around the globe. I'm Dee Dee Skanky. This week, Toyota navigates a round of recalls, Europe staggers under growing debt, and a dead dictator makes a comeback of sorts in Iraq. But we start this week's podcast in Pakistan. Karachi is Pakistan's largest city. It's also the country's main economic engine, and it's long attracted outsiders, among them tens of thousands of Pashtuns fleeing war in both Afghanistan and northwest Pakistan. Authorities in Karachi say the latest wave of migrants contains more than refugees. From Karachi, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports on a suspected Taliban hotspot and the large migrant population that's come under suspicion.
In Karachi's latticework of no-go zones, the area known as Sohrabgarh holds its own peculiar terror.
We are now in Sohrabgarh, and obviously we're heading towards the large spare parts market where there have been a number of police encounters which have taken place.
In a crackdown on pro-Taliban militants here last year, the suspects took policemen hostage, killing two of them and seriously wounding the chief of the city's anti-violent crime unit, according to journalist Hassan Abdullah. Crime reporter for Pakistan's Dawn Television News, Hassan is our guide into the notorious shanty town, where he says militants find cover in a cauldron of crime.
There have been confrontations between the police and land mafia. There have been clashes between the land mafia and political parties. There have been clashes between rival land mafia groups. There are far too many actors in there, and sometimes it's difficult to know who is who.
And along with those actors, you've got militants.
Absolutely.
Roughly 200,000 Pashtuns live in Sohrabgarh, many of them with no registration, so they don't officially exist. Hassan says jihadis who fought at the Soviets in Afghanistan are here, along with the members of the Pakistani Taliban, who are battling Pakistan's army in the Pashtun-speaking northwest frontier. Hassan says day by day, new groups seem to be emerging.
And now they seem to have a single-point agenda of, first of all, expelling what they call the invaders, or the allies of the invaders, and then imposing a system of their choice.
Pakistan's largest spare parts market for heavy machinery has sprouted up in the middle of this forsaken spot. Sewage runs in the streets. Electricity is siphoned from an ingeniously jury-rigged pole. Lifeless drapes hang half in, half out of the bent and broken windows of apartment blocks. Yet the streets are alive on a Sunday morning. Alleyways spring to life with ear-popping earth movers, while mangy dogs dodge traffic and donkey carts buzz with fly-encrusted sweets. Judging from the chaos, it wouldn't seem difficult for a militant to melt into the maw of this refugee community where there is not a policeman in sight. Hassan says the Taliban might as well be invisible.
For example, in front of us, if a dozen people are standing right now, how do you tell who's a militant and who's not? You know, none of them may be a militant, all of them may be militants, or a few of them may be militants. You can't tell.
Pashtun passers-by, their woolen shawls tightly wrapped against the morning chill, pay no heed to outsiders, slowly cruising the warren of potholed lanes.
Look at this warren inside here, and this is obviously the mosque.
This is a mosque and a madrasa complex. And if you were to be surrounded in this area, there's absolutely no way for you to escape from here. And, you know, it doesn't take much for you, let's say, to be accused of being a spy. A lot of skepticism in this area. You know, skepticism, poverty can be a very deadly combination.
Hassan says the Pashtuns who have been here since the first Afghan war feel a keen alienation.
They still feel that they're not being provided with education, health facilities, social support, and there's sometimes a feeling that there is a deliberate attempt of social stratification and to keep them out of the society. That doesn't help them. That doesn't help in fighting crime. That doesn't help in fighting militancy.
Karachi Mayor Mustafa Kamal says more than two dozen cells of Taliban militants have been broken up in what he insists is a creeping Talibanization of his city. He says the latest arrivals have sneaked in disguised as refugees displaced by the fighting in Waziristan along Pakistan's border with Afghanistan.
We cannot hide and close our eyes to see the dangers here in Karachi. No, if Karachi destabilizes, the whole country destabilizes because we generate 70% of the whole country's revenue.
The mayor and his supporters say the estimated 150,000 Afghan Pashtuns who are not properly registered should be removed. But veteran diplomat Zafar Halali rejects the insinuation that the Pashtun population at large is in cahoots with the Taliban.
They do not support the extremism of the Taliban, and I think it's a slur on the name of the Pashtuns to bracket them as Taliban. However, there are elements within the Pashtuns, naturally, obviously, the Masoods, the Waziris, the tribals are here. Obviously, there must be people who support them. There are people who sympathize with them. There are people who help them.
30-year-old Zabit Khan says he exemplifies what most Pashtuns think of the Taliban. He says painting his community with the broad brush of the militancy is deeply offensive. Khan says his family sought refuge in Karachi from the tribal agency of Araksai when it was overrun by the Taliban, whom Khan says were systematically killing the educated class. My brother was a doctor, trying to help people understand that the militants were only fooling them, Khan says. They kidnapped him, and when we could not deliver the ransom in 24 hours, they killed him. They are slaughtering good men and are not sincere, Khan says. Karachi has been largely spared attacks by the Taliban that have afflicted other parts of Pakistan. Analysts suspect the Taliban is using Karachi to rest and regroup. Ambassador Hilali says the militants have made a conscious decision to leave Karachi alone.
Karachi is the place where they say they receive a lot of their money from. So why should they come and disturb the scene in Karachi?
In this port city, the militants can also stay well out of the reach of the Americans, their drones, and the Pakistan Army. Julie McCarthy, NPR News.
And now to debt in Europe. The economic woes of Spain, Portugal, and especially Greece are causing instability in the so-called Eurozone, the 16 nations that use the euro as their currency. This is affecting two of America's big trading partners. In a moment, we'll hear about conditions in Britain. We start with Europe's strongest economy, Germany. NPR's Eric Westervelt reports from Berlin.
First, the good news. A modest appreciation of the euro's value could, in the short term, help Germany's export-dependent economy. But Christian Dräger with the German Institute for Economic Research says there is some fear that if the Greek government doesn't keep to the very tough austerity measures it agreed with the European Commission, it could spark a more dangerous plunge in the value of the euro.
A debt crisis in Greece could be a financial crisis as well. So many German banks are engaged in Greece, for example, and this would probably lead to a further crisis in the euro area.
The debt and deficit crises in Greece, Spain, and Portugal underscore a political problem in the European Union that has dogged the Eurozone's 11-year history. These 16 countries share a common currency, but lack a way to effectively coordinate fiscal policy. Economist Markus Kerber says the Greek debt crisis exposes the fallacy that you can have a common currency with such different economies and governments as Greece and the Netherlands. He says there are small nations in the zone who've been getting a free ride, not making tough economic decisions, knowing the euro currency will be held up by the strength of the German, French, and Dutch economies. He hopes the crisis spurs both political and fiscal reforms.
And the sooner the European community and the sooner the European Monetary Union becomes conscious of the free rider behavior of a relatively small state, the better it is in order to reform the mechanism. So we restrict the real danger to a tumbling down of the walls of Greece.
But some politicians fear that will create a two-tier eurozone and undermine the very political benefits that were supposed to come with a unified currency. Eric Westervelt, NPR News, Berlin.
This is Rob Gifford in London, where, despite Britain's many problems, the press has been wallowing in its new acronym for the countries of Southern Europe. The first letters of Portugal, Italy, Greece and Spain spell it out: PIGS. But former senior economist at the IMF, Simon Johnson, says Britain should not be gloating at countries like Greece.
Greece is an extreme example, but unfortunately the budget situation in these other countries is also weak. And I have to add the UK to this list. You know, unless you can persuade the markets that you're really going to bring the budget under control within the foreseeable future, you're going to have big trouble.
The concern is that British debt could possibly rise to 100% of GDP by 2013. One big difference, though, is that Britain is not in the euro currency, so it still controls its own interest rates, and the exchange rate of the pound sterling gives flexibility. Alistair Newton of Nomura in London thinks the southern European countries are very different from Britain.
They already had larger fiscal deficits because of structural impediments in their economy. And it's those structural impediments which need to be addressed in those economies. The UK dealt with many of those issues during the 1980s and 1990s.
The biggest structural issue is labour market reform, a hot topic across the Irish Sea as well, where some say the I in PIGS should be Ireland, not Italy. But, says Alistair Newton, Ireland has by and large taken the tough measures in public spending that Southern Europe is balking at.
The Irish government made a number of very tough decisions, bringing in a biting austerity programme. And I think both Ireland and the UK have benefited from, to an extent, is that during the boom periods, both benefited from a considerable influx of foreign workers from Eastern Europe in particular. And a lot of those workers actually went home when the slowdown came.
So while Britain and Ireland may not be pigs to the slaughter, just yet anyway, they've found their way into the other latest acronym that covers, rather loosely, Spain, Turkey, United Kingdom, Portugal, Ireland and Dubai, known collectively on the trading floors here as STUPID. Rob Gifford, NPR News.
Coming up, Saddam makes a comeback, well, at least his image does, and learning the Toyota way.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the all-new MDX with super-handling all-wheel drive. More information is available at Acura.com.
This is Foreign Dispatch. I'm Didi Skanky. There's little joy these days in Toyota City. The world's biggest automaker this week announced its latest recall, nearly 440,000 Prius and other hybrids. Toyota has already apologized for the recall of more than 8 million vehicles over faulty gas pedals and floor mats. NPR's Louisa Lim reports.
This is ground zero of the Toyota meltdown. I'm standing beside a modern steel and glass building, which is Toyota's headquarters here in Toyota Town in Toyota City. And this entire city basically revolves around Toyota. And I've come here to try to find an answer to the question that many people are asking. Just how did things go so badly wrong for the world's top automaker?
This is the Toyota production system, where manufacturers eliminate waste to provide customers with well-made products in a timely manner.
A film at a Toyota museum outlines one part of the Toyota way. This philosophy underpins and unites the entire company. It's almost like a religion for employees. But old-timers say the efficiency drive was taken too far. Hisayoshi Atsumi drives a taxi now, a Toyota, of course. Before that, he worked for Toyota for 29 years.
I think what caused the current problems is that Toyota cut costs excessively. They squeezed and squeezed, and even when there was nothing left to squeeze, they squeezed some more. That makes the workers' jobs hard.
Not only are their jobs hard, but Toyota regulates its employees' lives to an extraordinary degree. Here, Tadao Wakatsuki is demonstrating the Toyota way of turning corners when you walk. Stop first, look left, okay? Look right, okay? Look forward, okay, nobody's coming, 90-degree turn. That's how everyone who works for Toyota turns corners. Wakatsuki spent his entire working life at Toyota, 45 years of service. He enumerates some other Toyota rules.
If you walk around with your hands in your pockets, you'll be told to take them out. If you drive to work, you'll file a report describing the route you take and the risks. I would say there's no freedom at Toyota. It's totalitarian.
4 years ago, he started his own union, the All Toyota Labor Union. Worried that standards were slipping too far, he wrote to management outlining his fears.
The same cheap parts are used in too many different models. Design and planning is outsourced and it's done by computers. The trial and error period for new cars is too short, and there's a shortage of experienced workers.
He believes Toyota's fatal flaw was its global ambition. It overreached its capabilities and cut too many corners to snag the number one spot. The troubles were known by its workers, he said, but the emphasis on conformity meant few spoke out. But one Toyota man did speak out. Last October, he publicly accused the company of being guilty of hubris born of success, of undisciplined pursuit of more, and of the denial of risk. That man was none other than Toyota's president, Akio Toyoda, who was outlining the stages described in a book by Jim Collins called How the Mighty Fall. Toyota's grasping for salvation, he said, or else it faces irrelevance or death. Louisa Lim, NPR News, Toyota City, Japan.
And now to autocrats and the people who miss them. There came a time in Russia when people felt nostalgia for the ruthless dictator Joseph Stalin. Something similar may be happening in parts of Iraq, where some people venerate the memory of Saddam Hussein. Iraq's one-time ruler was executed some 3 years ago, yet you could be forgiven for thinking he was a candidate in parliamentary elections next month. NPR's Lourdes Garcia-Navarro reports from Iraq's Anbar province, where Saddam remains a popular figure.
His familiar face with its ink-black mustache is blown up to the size of a whole wall in this mobile phone shop in Ramadi. Smaller pictures of Saddam Hussein, hunting, making speeches, are hung up behind the counter. Shop Workers Aid plays a recording of Saddam saved on his cell phone. He says Saddam Hussein, who was executed in 2006, is making a comeback.
Many people put his picture up and keep videos of him on their cell phones and praise him and talk about him.
The reason, say residents, is disillusionment with the current Shiite-led government and the local Sunni provincial council. Anbar suffered years of brutal war that pitted U.S. forces against al-Qaeda and other insurgents. Now, it's less violent, but people here, like Zaid, say life is still hard, with few services and no jobs.
It's only now that we've discovered how valuable Saddam was to us. People have compared the situation before to the situation now, and then was better.
Since the Americans have pulled out, says Zaid, people have become bolder in displaying Saddam's image.
We couldn't put the picture up before because of the Americans. If they passed by and saw a picture of Saddam, they would arrest us, suspecting us of being insurgents.
Well, for many Iraqis, Saddam and his Ba'ath Party inspired loathing. Anbar provided many of the officers in Saddam's army and senior members of his toppled regime. At the nearby barbershop, 35-year-old Hamid Salim says that's left a sense of nostalgia for the Saddam era.
Saddam's popularity is back because Saddam gave Iraqis dignity. Now Iraqis have no dignity whatsoever.
It's a constant lament among the Anbaris interviewed by NPR. Saddam, for all his faults, they say, was a leader who inspired fear and respect. Salim, like many here, says he won't vote in the upcoming elections. Sunnis largely boycotted the 2005 elections. Last year, in a provincial poll, Anbar still ranked lowest in terms of voter participation, with only around 40% of people coming to vote amid charges of fraud. At a recent meeting in Anbar, Khalid Mohammed Rajab from the Independent High Electoral Commission sought to persuade the gathered crowd that the elections this time will be free and fair.
In these elections, everybody knows they must be impartial, and we want to make sure that all the people of Anbar participate.
One member of the audience, Sheikh Amash al-Ubaidi, stood up to express his skepticism.
Frankly speaking, there are people who are suspicious that fraud will take place in the elections, and we say to them, you are right.
Residents of Anbar don't have to travel far to see the promises of the Electoral Commission ring hollow. On the same day, at a checkpoint on Anbar's main highway, Iraqi soldiers were handing out calendars emblazoned with a picture of Iraq's Shiite Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki. One soldier told an NPR reporter that he was ordered to distribute them by his commander. Another soldier smiles and presses more flyers through the window of the car, saying, "This is Maliki. May God preserve him for you." Back at the mobile phone shop in Ramadi, owner Abu Muhammad says, at least when Saddam was in power, people knew what to expect. He says, today we hear promises from politicians. We will do this or that. Things will change. We will rebuild. But he says, the next morning we wake up to the same situation or even worse. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News.
For more international coverage, you can listen to your local NPR station. You'll find a list at our website, npr.org. And while you're there, you can find more international stories by clicking on News and World. For NPR News, I'm Dee Dee Skanky.